Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Because the historical study is rather long, I asked Phil to come read the background to me. I want you to follow with him in 1 Samuel chapter 22, verses 9 through 23. This is the story or the account of the terrible slaughter of Saul by the whole house of Elimelech, and it sets the background for this particular psalm. But Phil?
Well, we're going to read this all at the same time first together, aren't we? Just start with the ninth verse. All right, here we are. I'll give you 1 minute, too. This is 1 Samuel, 22nd chapter, and starting with the ninth verse to the end. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitab. And he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitab, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob, and they came all of them to the king. And Saul said, Hear now, thou son of Ahitab. And he answered, Here I am, my lord. And Saul said unto him, Why have you conspired against me, thou son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at this day? Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, And who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in thine house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, for my servant know nothing of all this, less or more. And the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, Turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled, and did not show it to me. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, Turn thou, and fall upon the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned, and he fell upon the priests, and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep, with the edge of the sword. And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priest. And David said unto Abiathar, I knew at that day, when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Abide thou with me, fear not. For he that seeketh thy life seeketh thy life. Excuse me. For he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life. But with me thou shalt be in safeguard.
Can you imagine the immensity of what's happened? Nob was a place, the temple is not built yet. There are local shrines throughout the country where people go to worship. There was a house of the Lord at a town called Nob. And the priest there, when David came through, as you find over in 1 Samuel chapter 11, when he came through, gave him some bread because David asked, gave him the sword of Goliath. This other herdsman was there, Doeg, and he went and told Saul later. It doesn't seem like that he really was after the priestly family. It just happened to be the occasion. He shot off his mouth. This was a very unusual kind of man. He was the kind of man who, when the guards in the palace would not kill the priest, he himself personally killed 85 priests that day. And then he went to the city and he killed their wives and all the men and all the children and all the donkeys and all the cattle in all that city. Now, this is a real problem for us to understand why. I want you to realize, get your Hebrew mind thinker on, if you would, please. Let's go back to an Old Testament context. Let's go back to the doctrine of corporality. Now, remember when Achan stole the mantle and all that stuff out of Jericho when he wasn't supposed to, and the whole Israeli army lost the next day, and Of course, when they found out who did it, he was killed, Achan, Achan's wife, Achan's children, Achan's cattle, everything was killed because of Achan's sin. And we have a real problem understanding that. The same thing is when we have a real problem understanding original sin. The same idea of corporality that we see here is the same concept that says in Adam, all men have sinned. It's the Hebrew understanding that it is not individualistic. It's tribal-oriented, national-oriented, family group-oriented. With one person sinned, it was a group that sinned. And so the terrible thing, you can imagine David's heart as he reflected back on the fact that he had personally, because of just passing through here, caused the death of all these people. And it really got to him. Now, the question is, who is this psalm referring to? Is it referring to Doeg or is it referring to Saul? Now, the commentaries are split on this. If you really look at it, I think it's referring mostly to Saul, because when it calls him a mighty man, when it talks about great riches, seems to refer to Saul himself and not simply to Doeg. And yet, this is the historical setting. So, this psalm is only 8-9 verses. Let's read those together. And I want you to read them silently, if you would, in your translation. And then let's go back and look at them together. Read verses 1 through 9 silently in your translation, please. Because it doesn't mention the killing of the priest. I think there's something much deeper here, and that's the attitudes of, I believe, Saul's heart. Now, notice where it says in verse 1, it says, boast in evil, and down in verse 2 it says, your tongue devises destruction. Hebrew, being a very ancient language, does not have a large vocabulary, and it does not it's not as highly a developed, inflected language as Greek. Therefore, it's hard to put a whole lot of meaning on the verb tenses of the Hebrew. And yet there are specific verb tenses, but they include much more than they do in Greek. These are future tense. It's not saying that why will you boast, or why will you devise destruction. It's a Hebrew way of picking up the present and of talking about what he's going to do. It's a way of saying this is his disposition, attitude now, and this is the way he intends to live in the future. It's that kind of thing. Now, when it says, why do you boast within of evil, O mighty man? Now, O mighty man is one Hebrew word, and it's used for many numbers of warriors and men of valor, political leaders, that kind of thing. I don't think it's sarcastic here. I really don't. I think it's like saying, how could you have such importance and be in such a place of responsibility and do this kind of thing? That's kind of what David is saying to Saul. How could God place you in such a place of wonderful responsibility as the king of his people, and you do this kind of thing? Now, you see where it says loving kindness? What is that word? Hesed. Now, it's very important that you understand the word hesed. It's translated mercy, I think, in King James. Is there any other translation here tonight? The loving kindness of God endures all day. Is your translation different? Yes, Linda. First verse, second line. Psalms 52. What translation do you have? Read it. Read the whole thing for me. Oh, okay. I tell you what they've done.
If you know, Hebrew is built on consonants and not vowels. And this is the pronoun with hesed. If you change the consonant of hesed and put this little article to the back, you get this word, the other, mischief or that kind of thing. And that's what they've done there. It's really not, what they've done is change the Hebrew text around to make it that word fit. But I think hesed fits real well here, so I have left hesed. I think most translations do. This is the settled, complete, full will of God to love his people no matter what. If there is any unconditional element in the Old Testament, more and more that I say of the Old Testament, the farther and farther I'm coming away from the unconditional promises. It seems to me that everything God said to man is conditional in his response. But if there is, and I think there probably is some element of an unconditional promise, it's in this word hesed. It means that God is going to love you
when you spit in his face, and when you rebel against him, and when you get off, and when you run away. God has chosen you, and he's going to love you. And that is a beautiful concept in a day when this kind of thing could happen. Now, you see where it says the word in chapter two, verse 2, your tongue devises destruction. Now, this is a Hebrew word that means calculated, premeditated, sitting down, planning the destruction of somebody or something. And that's what makes it so evil. It's not just hitting somebody with a car, maybe, as an accident, but it's standing by and waiting until they get in the middle of the street to hit them with a car. And it's that kind of word. Now, notice how he's depicted. Like a sharp razor, O worker of deceit, you love evil more than good. The word love here is in past tense in Hebrew. Again, it's hard to nail these tenses down, but it picks up the present, and in picking up the present, it speaks of the past. And so what it says is that Saul had come to the place in his life that his attitude toward life was one of calling the bad things good. He had come to that kind of place. I think Saul was mentally deranged, and I think it shows itself several times. Now, whatever happened to him, when he was a young man, he was not this way, but he became that way in later life, and he just really acted in ways that seemed implied that he really had lost his mind. Now, what it comes to mean here is that he came to the place that he couldn't even tell good from evil. He was that far off. This is the exact kind of thing that's talked about as the unpardonable sin in the New Testament. When you cannot tell the difference between good or when God is acting and when the evil is acting or Satan is acting, there's no possibility for God to speak to you because you've lost all frame of references. And that's exactly what's happened here. Now, let's go down to verse 5. Now, the word, does your tradition have but or also, or what does that mean? Would you have that, but or also? That means that this next paragraph is linked. It's kind of saying, Saul is like this. He's out to get you. His tongue is a razor. He can't tell anything good and evil. But as Saul is like this, God is like this. And notice what God is like in this verse. Just look at the verbs. God will break down. God will snatch you up. God will tear you away. And God will uproot you from the land. You act this way, God will act this way. Now, this is that theology we've talked about several times, that Psalm 73 is against, that the book of Job is against. It says, if you sin in this life, God will get you. Now, there is a sense in which we reap what we sow in this life. You hear me? You reap what you sow in this life. But the basic understanding of God's judgment is, at the end of the road, when life is over, that's basically when God's judgment comes about. Because the psalmist and Job were lamenting the fact that some men who did the most terrible kind of crimes were the richest and the healthiest and the seemingly outward the happiest, and it didn't fit. So this theology is an older kind of theology. I think it's valid to an extent. And I'll tell you why. And this has always bothered me because it doesn't fit with my regular understanding of how God works. I've told you many times that God, like, let's say, let me take an example. In the Old Testament, when David sinned against Uriah and his wife Bathsheba, and a child was conceived, and God told David that child is going to die. Now, my natural theology, my mainline theology would say, God loved that baby as much as he loved David or anybody else. And God wouldn't inflict any kind of judgment on that innocent child for the sin of David. Now, that's mainline theology. And that's good New Testament theology. But simply to say, there are times when God alters that. Now, I think that child went right to heaven. But still to say, that child was affected by what their parents did. It's not often. It's mostly in the Old Testament. But there seems to be that kind of, at least a small trend of that kind of thing. Now, notice what God said. The word for breakdown is a word that comes from tearing down a house. Now, that's very important because I am going to change 5ABC. Your translation probably has something like, and uproot you from the land of the living. The Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, says, and thy root taken away
from the land of the living. Now, what I'm talking about here, I've told you many times, the Old Testament does not have a deep understanding of eternal life. They understood some kind of shadowy existence in Sheol. They understood a place where you couldn't praise God, where you were miserable, where you were just a shadow of yourself. Now, what this, and a way that people believed that they lived eternally was in their children. Now, I think what God is saying here is, I'll take you, and I'll take your seed. Now, I get it from this idea that he'll break down, and the word, you could almost apply the word your house, because that's what this word's always used for, and an example is Leviticus 14, 45. And then this word about, I will snatch you up. This word snatch you up is always used for taking coals out of a fire to go next door and start a new fire. But the Hebrew mind would understand that if you take, well, just think about your fireplace. If you take one log out of your fireplace and put it by itself, I don't care how bright it's burning, that log will die. One log can't burn, can it, Jack? Longest time, Jack said, my fireplace just isn't burning. And I said, what do you think's the matter? He said, well, that one log won't burn. I said, well, you can't burn one log. You got to burn two or three. And it's the same with coals. You pile coals up and they'll stay hot all night, but you spread them out and they go very cold. That's exactly what the Hebrew mind would get here. By pulling his coal away from the bunch, cutting him off from the people, we would cease to be. The word tear down is a word that's also used, this idea of tearing down something like a home. And then I think that this thing about uproot you from the land of the living could better be understood by us to say, take thy root out of the land of the living, which means his offspring would be taken away. And that's the ultimate kind of judgment in the Old Testament sense. Now, you see what it says in verse 6, and righteousness, the righteous will see and fear. Describe to me the word fear in the Old Testament context. What does fear mean when it's used of God? Awe, reverence, what else? Trust, maybe a silence at the magnificence of God. A realizing your createdness, that kind of thing. It's not a running and frightful fear like, you know, you've watched a horror show and you cover your head with your pillow or something. It's a settled, reverent attitude, knowing that you stand in the presence of someone to whom you have no right standing in his presence. That kind of fear. Now, it says that the righteous are going to see him, see what happens to this guy, and fear, and they will laugh at him. Turn me to Proverbs 24:17. Proverbs 24:17. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles. Relate for me Proverbs 24:17 and this passage where it says they'll laugh at him. How do you relate those two? How do you fit those together in your understanding? Well, this is talking about us, and I'll put it in our context. This is talking about us standing on the corner and seeing somebody that we haven't liked, that we feel like they've got the good things out of life and they've done it in an evil way, and boy, they really get theirs, and we just really say, boy, sock it to them, God. Fantastic. Hit them again, you know. Really crush them. I'm so tickled they're down, and that kind of thing. And I think it's totally out of the will of God. I think the word laughter here has got to have different context than that kind of laughter. I think it's got to be taken with the ideal of fear. And maybe what we have here is a chuckle at the word of God coming true and the honor of God being vindicated, and not so much a happiness at someone else's demise as it is a gladness in the strength and the will and the justice of God. Now, I have to relate those that way. For I think even the Old Testament, this understanding about laughing at your enemies when they fall is not the people of God's attitude. Now, notice what it says. These righteous are going to fear and laugh because of what? Because this man would not make God his refuge, and he trusted in, and I want to put blank blank there. For if I tried to list all the ways and all the things that men trusted in anything but God, I would leave you out. But I will ask you a question. In the practical analysis of your life, what or who are you trusting in? That takes some somber reflection. For all of us outwardly tend to trust on things that are physical. And it's only the attitude of our heart toward physical things that make them either evil or good. And I'll take an example. When I was a very young preacher, Peggy and I were first married, I had a real problem with life insurance. Now, you may not have a problem. I don't anymore. I did then. I thought, God called me to preach. God will take care of me. Peggy's young and pretty. Worst came to worst, you know. And I had a real problem with it. Then I came, I think, to another understanding that maybe I have some responsibility in this area as a Christian husband. So I took out some life insurance, just in case. Don't think it'll happen. May happen, just in case. Now, if my attitude was, now I've got everything set, I can just live it up, then the life insurance has become a crutch. But if the attitude is, it's there in case we need it, just in case, not trusting in it, I'm just using one example of many, the attitude of how you look at things is really the criteria by which they become the things of God or the things of devil. For you see, things are neutral. There is no evil thing. It's how we handle things. It's how we use things that make them evil or of God. Now, he handled his kingness. I want you to remember that the king of Israel was God's representative on earth, and Saul abused that high, high honor. And he used his power to crush people, and he used his authority as king to malign people and lie. So the most beautiful gift that God had given, and that is his representative on earth to rule his people, even though he was against it at first, is the very thing that man in his sinfulness twisted to become a tool of the devil. And I want to tell you this, anything can become that twisted if you don't watch it. Anything can become twisted. My understanding of how Satan works in our lives today is not that he comes as a demon or as a miraculous worker of miracles usually, but he has so many inroads in our life. He has so many ways of twisting the good just enough till it becomes slightly evil. Just enough ways of crippling us in the name of goodness, in the name of value, in the name of helping others. That usually he comes to us in these very insidious ways. And the hardest choice that I have to make is usually not between something that's totally black and totally white, but between two or three or four or 20 things that look outwardly good. And that's the hardest choice to make in all the world. Now, verse 8. David says, I'm like a green olive tree. Well, that's terrific. Why a green olive tree? Why an olive tree? Why does David compare himself to an olive tree? How many of y'all have seen pictures of the Garden of Gethsemane? You ever seen pictures? Have you ever seen a picture of that beautiful olive tree that's still there, has the fence around it? I got a little tickle. Brother Swank came back and he said, he had this little thing with him. I said, what is that? He said, olives. Where'd you get them? He said, I picked them off a tree in the Garden of Gethsemane. I said, you picked them off that olive tree? No wonder they built a fence around it. Everybody go in there and pick an olive branch off. That poor tree wouldn't last very long. So it's in a fence now. But that tree is estimated to be 2,000 years old. An olive tree. Now, that's what David's talking about, a long-living, perpetual kind of thing, to live that long. And notice where he is, in the house of God. This is where some critical commentaries say, this shows you that the psalm can't be linked to the title because the temple's not built yet, and on they go, and they forget that the whole context of this is what? The house of God, not at Jerusalem, but at Nob. So, that's where I think it is. I think it's the local temple there. Now, the word I trust, in the last part of verse 8, is a past tense Hebrew verb. Speaks of the present, but goes back into the past with the understanding that his settled disposition of life is trust. It means he trusts in every circumstance. It means he trusts in every day. He doesn't wait till things are going good. But his settled disposition toward life is trust in God. That's a very good characteristic. Now, in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. Now, this in English, this seems to imply that David's saying, I'm going to trust forever and ever, meaning he's going to live forever and ever. That's not what the Hebrew implies. The Hebrew implies, I trust in God, whose characteristic is hesed kind of faithfulness, and this hesed faithfulness in God will go on forever and ever. It's not talking about his immortality. It's talking about the eternality of the characteristics of God. Now, you see where it says, I will give thanks forever? Now, here we go with a beautiful expression. He's not saying, again, I'm going to live forever and give thanks forever. He's saying, in every circumstance, as long as I'm here, no matter what befalls me, be it running from Saul, be it trapped by the Philistines, whatever befalls me, I'm going to give thanks. Now, that reminds me of a few New Testament verses I know. In everything, with prayer and supplication, let your requests be known to God. And the word thanksgiving is in there, isn't it? Give thanks in all things. That is a very hard thing to do. And I am not the kind of guy who has a wreck and says, oh, thank God I've had a wreck. I'm so excited I've hit somebody. Or, you know, smash my finger with a hammer and say, I'm so thrilled. I have now smashed my finger. I know it's going to work out for the best. No, but I tell you this. I can look back at the tragedies in my life and through the years, the thing that I thought was so terribly bad and brutal and no purpose and ugly has been the very thing that's made me the kind of man I am and give me the strength that I have. The good times have been great. I know God's there. But the things that have formed my character and built my backbone and based my theology have been the hard things. I think if we ever learn to give thanks in all things, not a joyous hallelujah, but a God, I know you're in control kind of response. There's got to be a purpose in this. Though it hurts, though I don't see it, though I'm confused, I will trust you, God, and when I possibly can, I will thank you for it. Now, because thou hast done it, now there you go. I'm afraid a little bit of my Calvinism shows out. David had a settled disposition that God was in control, not of some things, not of big things, not of major things, not of things in the past, but God was in control of everything. Now, I want to, in saying that, you have to let me mingle something with that. And with that God in control has got to be a corresponding half that God has allowed man to have free will. And somehow with God in control, he has allowed man to have a free will, and sometimes man can gum up the works. But even when man gums up the works, God changes it to grease, and pretty soon it oils the machine. You hear what I'm saying? Yes, God's in control. Some things happen that aren't in what God would like to happen, but even the things that come from evil people, God can use for his glory if we trust him. And a good example is called Calvary. And a good example is called the denial of Peter. And a good example is called the dispersion of the church at Jerusalem. And a good example is called the selling of Joseph into slavery by his brothers. And on it goes. So God is in control, and God uses even man's mistakes to his glory. And, of course, we've got to be involved in that. Now, the last one I like very much, I will wait on thy name, for it is good. Now, what does he mean? What is the understanding, Hebrew understanding of the phrase, thy name? I heard somebody say something. Character. What David's saying is, and I let me hear this, because I just really do. What is the characteristic of God that you love the most? Some would say, God is all-powerful. Friends, I don't love God because he's all-powerful. Some would say, God is all-knowing. I don't love God because he's all-knowing. I love God because he's love. because he's characterized by the Hebrew word hesed, which means, though I fail, yet will he love me. When I fall, he'll pick me up. When I sin, he'll forgive me. And he won't do it because of me, because there's no merit in me. He'll do it because of himself, because he loves mankind. Why do I love God? Well, the scripture says, because he first loved us. And that is the character of God that I love. You know, we say it too often that ultimate power is not necessarily a good thing, is it? But ultimate love? Notice what it says, the last little part. It is good in the presence of the godly ones. And notice the little phrase here, it says, I will wait on thy name. I've got a cartoon in my office under my desk that you all know. It says, Lord, give me patience and give it to me now. I think the hardest word in the Bible is wait. Wait for what? Well, wait till I figure out what to do? No. Wait till God acts on my plans? No. Wait for what? Wait for the character of God that's love, knowing that whatever comes is going to be the best for you and the best for him, and therefore we trust it to him, and we go right on. Wait on the character of God. You say, I'll be happy to wait if it comes in 48 hours. Sometimes we have to wait a long, long time, don't we? And the more we wait, not the weaker we get, but the stronger we get. Wait on the character of God in the presence of thy godly ones. Here's another example. It's the word, almost the word saint. It's not a Hebrew word, but it's the same concept. Have you ever noticed that the word saint never appears alone? Nowhere in the Bible is the word saint in the singular. There is no such thing as a saint. It's only in the community of faith that God's character is seen, that we wait for his presence. We're linked together. That's why we are the concept of the family of God. We're like the coal. If we're taken off by ourselves, we die. Together we glow and glow and glow and glow. So, it's good in the presence, and I would change it a little bit to say, of God's people. All right. What do you see here from your background experience? What does this psalm say to you? I've dealt with some pretty deep theology and points, and if you have questions, I'll try to comment anyway. Anybody? Yes. I think it's the only lasting security. I really think that, Jenny, we're so linked into a chronological, physical, time-space universe that we even put heaven like that. We talk about a mansion in heaven as if there wasn't a mansion there, it wouldn't be heaven, you know. But to me, the reality of God being there makes it heaven. So I think spirit is the only lasting reality. I think matter is a thing that's going to come and go. And so therefore, I think it is. Yeah. It doesn't look like it, but I think it is. That's where Greek philosophy and Christianity basically differ. Greek philosophy says that God and matter have existed from the beginning. Christianity says, in the beginning, God, period. Everything came from him. Do you like this psalm? Did you see the marvelous things that are here, even though the setting that gave rise to it is so disastrous? Now just think for a minute of these wives and children and young men and all this being slaughtered. You think, yeah, how can, that's just terrible. And it was just gross. But out of this, God used it. Very hard to understand.